We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix. Joining me today is the founder of the Morgan Report, David Morgan. How are you today, David?
Tom, I'm well, and thanks for having me back.
Great to have you as always. So you recently wrote a piece called All Wars Are Bankers' Wars. So how are you using that idea to kind of help frame your understanding of what is happening right now in Ukraine?
Well, actually, the quote, All Wars Are Bankers' Wars, is from a documentary by, I think it's Michael Rivero. And I gave the link in my, my private work, the premium service, the paid service. And I said, watch the documentary, and I've watched it twice. And he makes a very strong case that the bankers usually fund both sides of the war, and they're that for whatever the outcome is, they win and everyone else loses. No one really gains in a war. So that is a premise. I started to do this analysis on how I saw things, Tom. And as you know, I sent it to you so you could have a read. The next thought, of course, is that if you really want to be objective in the journalism industry, which, I consider myself a metals analyst, but whatever you want to call me, put on my journalism hat for a moment or three, it's to follow the money. Mm-hmm. So that's very important. And the last one is a quote that's, been tossed around a lot lately, and that's first, casualty of war is truth. And I'll have to add on to it. Cliff High put out one of his Substacks, I believe, recently, saying actually it's the first thing to go is innocence. I won't go too far down there. I won't disagree with that either. But there's a lot to lose and not a lot to gain. Having said that, what I found really, probably one of the toughest months to write the editorial I've ever done. All kinds of information, disinformation, misinformation, exaggeration, fake news, fake movies, fake, trusted sources. I mean, really tough. So I did my humanly best to try to ferret out what was true and what was false. And what came across my desk, as you know, since you read it, was that there was purportedly, and I don't know if it's a fact, some animation, some ideas of the past with Malachi Martin, who was a Catholic priest from the Vatican, or at least associated with the Vatican. I believe it was in the Vatican for a while, talking about Ukraine and Russia and being kind of in the end times, and that it was a precursor to things getting better, actually. So I put that in there, so everyone could read it, and then I just went on and tried to be as objective as possible. I think the key takeaways are this. All wars are bankers' wars, so the probability is that Putin is more or less controlled opposition. I'd like to throw out a bunch of hopium out there that that's not the case. Facts are, I don't know. Certainly, we can build a huge case that, Putin is, Soros hates him and vice versa. The World Economic Forum has taken everything to do with Putin off their website and all this. But is this, reality, or is this to further the idea that, there really are an adversary? So I don't know. It's really ugly. It's really upsetting. And it's very interesting. The last comment, and I'll give it back to you, Tom, is how the CV-19er just seemed to disappear once this thing started up.
Well, and it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because we're speaking on the morning of March the 14th here. And, you're seeing some reports of China that there are lockdowns again of a city of 17 million to contain some type of, spreading of the virus again. But, that gets buried in this plethora of news that we're facing every day. And I kind of wanted to get your thoughts. You mentioned the amount of disinformation and misinformation that we're facing. So how do you try to parse through that, David?
Well, pretty much my whole career, I have tried to look at both sides. So, a lot of the documentaries I watch are from the left. And, I boil it down to this. I've said this once or twice in my interviewing career. And this is my opinion, so you don't have to agree with me. But if you boil it down and really try to be elegant with your thinking, the impetus of capitalism is greed, and the impetus of socialism is jealousy. Now, if you take those two as a premise, what you've got is the greed side, which means, you know, as much as I can get for me and as little to you as possible, which is a corporate structure for a fair amount of, you know, of the corporate system. And the corporate system is global. I'm going to have to digress just a moment, Tom, and I know you're used to listening to me. But if you go to the power pyramid, as outlined by the movie Thrive One, and you look at the power structure, at the very bottom is us, the plebs and the animals and the trees and the soil. And right above that is government. So the base of the pyramid, they're not even shown on the pyramid. We're shown underneath the pyramid. And the base of the pyramid is government. And then one level up from government is corporates, global corporates. And I think that's very accurate. Then it goes into the banking system and on up through all the ranks of the banks, really. So the idea is that government's so powerful, but it's really not. It's the base of the pyramid. And we're in a system now with this digital currency system that's being unfolded where you could actually do away with government and go direct to your corporate entity. In other words, you could do away with the USD and have Amazon tokens and buy everything off of Amazon using their currency, and everything at the, you know, let's say a corporate grocery chain, three or four of them, and use their. So this is changing everything. But I digress to come back. I think one point I forgot to mention that you brought up was the illness. In that report, I said this. Remember, all that's happening with this Russia thing is brought to you by the same people that brought you the illness. And don't think the illness story is over. It will come back probably worse than ever. And I just want to get that on the record with you, Tom, because, you know, these people have got an agenda, and the agenda is very dark, and they don't give up. And it is a fight. And as a friend of mine in the same industry as me said, you know, you boil it down to five words, it's a war of good and evil. Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned earlier as well that the WEF and how Putin was, you know, at some time connected with them. So how do you see that, David?
I see it. Well, maybe it's the optimist or the American in me. I think there's a real possibility that there is a banker's war against the banks. This war is really against the banks, and that Putin et al. And, you know, I'm sure some of the high strung patriots may agree with me. It's to be determined. I wouldn't rule it out that this war is about control of the monetary system. And that's not determined yet. We're in flux. I mean, the purportedly decentralized finance has been hijacked, at least the number one, Bitcoin, that, you know, super libertarians came into early on. I kind of stood to the side. I wasn't convinced. Free market, buy the heck out of it. We determined, we on my crypto conspiracy series, that Bitcoin has been hijacked some time ago by basically the main members of the MasterCard Association, all those conglomerates and corporations. So again, it goes back to the corporate structure. And it was not just a hypothesis that me and John Perez pursued, but we got Kurt Wukert, who is an archivist or a historian on Bitcoin, and he basically verified the entities and gave us more than we had discovered. And then one of the, let's say, the legal team with the crypto that I'm involved with, that's gold and silver backed, had a hard look at all of this information and verified, yeah, it's basically been hijacked. My words, not theirs. So we've got that to consider. And then what do we hear is, you know, central bank. So again, I think we're in a position where we've got to be very careful with what the crypto world is going to do presently. But the outcome that they want, not necessarily will get, is pretty clear. They, the banking elites want to have a central bank digital currency that they control. Will they make the all the others null and void? Doubt it. Will they make them unacceptable for transactions? And this is my theory, where you couldn't use any altcoin that isn't a government-backed coin for individual purchases, but you couldn't use it for a mortgage, a home loan, anything that has to do with the banking credit system, you wouldn't be able to use that. Or the third choice, and there's more than I can think of, would be to roll them in. So for every XYZ token that you have, you get 0.001 Fed coin. So there's lots of options. And all that, again, is conjecture, because this thing could get out of hand. There, the idea of the unintended consequences. I mean, shutting down the SWIFT system is a big thing. And Russia is a pretty hardened people. And there's no doubt in my mind that Putin didn't see this coming, as far as once he made the decision and took action, what the repercussions would be. So they've probably mapped this thing out 3, 4, 10 times, you know, several times, with different scenarios, if this happens, then that, whatever. But, you know, if we look at real basic stuff, food and oil, especially oil or energy, Russia's in good shape. If you look at the ultimate money, gold, Russia's in good shape. So, yeah, the ruble's been crashed, but that's just a paper currency like the rest of them. So I was long-winded, Tom, but I will say, I'll summarize with this. I do believe that there is, I'd say, probably a 10, maybe 20% chance that this war is more than just a banker's war. It's a war against the banks. So I said it, throw the mud, throw the slings, throw the I don't know, throw I don't understand Bitcoin, throw everything that you want. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pay attention to it. I got other things to do, but comment away. And of course, you're free to comment. I mean, that's fine. I take the comments off of mine because I just don't have the time to respond to them. And then people get upset, like I'm not giving them my time. Look, I give a lot of time for free interviews. And I've got to do my research to write my report every month.
So, you know, in that vein, David, we saw Canada try to freeze some crypto wallets after the trucker protest. And we're now seeing Europe evaluate the framework around banning crypto as well. So do you see that as a strike against crypto? And or does that just reinforce your case for metals in your own possession?
Well, I'll answer the second part. First, the best decentralized finance you can have is physical metal. I mean, I don't care who you are and how sophisticated you are, and if you wrote code for your whole life, you know, you still have a counterparty risk. One is electricity. Two is the internet. Three is if you're on an exchange. And if you're off exchange and you got your code written down on a piece of paper, good for you. That's fine. I think that's smart. Mm-hmm. But you're still going to have to go in an electronic system sometime to transact. So nothing beats metal as far as having decentralized finance. As far as, you know, is Europe playing a game or not? I don't know. I really think that they don't know what to do. I know what they want to do, and I'll just outline it again briefly. They want control. Mm-hmm. They don't want to give up control. How to get it back is, as I said, do you ban it all? Do you make some? Do you convert it? What do you do with it? I think that a lot of it will just be banned. It'll be like the tech wreck in the 90s. Where I think it was 99, where all these dot-coms were flying high 1 minute, 2 minutes later, they were off the board. It didn't exist anymore. I think that's a good analogy for what will happen to the crypto world. Does that mean they're all going away? No. In the tech wreck, Amazon, Yahoo, eBay, a lot of these things, you know, are stalwarts now. But a lot of these, you know, XYZ.coms are no longer in existence and haven't been since they, you know, went away. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that a lot of these, you know, recent events have changed the public's view towards cash as well, David?
Definitely think it's had an impact on cash. You know, people get their programming from the TV, and the idea of cash is like it's not necessary. Then during the illness, it was dirty or it might carry the disease and all this stuff. So we've been moving toward a cashless society for a very, very long time. I'll give you a quick example, Tom. I mean, we've heard, you know, my ilk, the hard money writers, the free market thinkers that have written in the newsletter industry, and others, of course, you know, have talked for years about the global currency. And, you know, I was in, I think, Hong Kong, and I'd been through Europe. I've been through like 5 or 6 different countries. And I'm now standing there on stage in Hong Kong, and I held up my Visa card. And I said, there is a one world currency, and this is it. Because through all of those countries and all those hotel rooms and all those cups of coffee and all those, you know, meals, I used that plastic card and they did the conversion for me. I didn't have to worry about going down and finding their paper currency to transact business. So in a way, and that's been the theme, and it's convenient. And, you know, I'm not saying it's even wrong. I'm answering your question. Cash is not something that, you know, it's going to be around a lot longer. And of course, it's the most anonymous way to make a transaction. And that's what the bankers hate. When we go to a full digital system, they'll be able to track, trace, and tax everything you do. On top of that, there'll be an overlay of a social credit system, regardless of what they call it. Mm-hmm. And if they're telling you that you use too much carbon because you went out and drove your car too far, and you go in and you want to buy a steak, it's like, no, you got one or the other. You already drove your car, so you can't get a steak. You got to have this, you know, the stuff that we create, call it food, and that's your only choice. So it's a top-down control mechanism run primarily, and I'm not sure of this. I've had guests that I've interviewed, and I'm not smart enough to know. I should probably get Cliff High and ask him. So I think his opinion's better or different than mine, but I know there's some AI involved. How, to what level, I'm not sure. But, you know, there's no one entity. There's one guy behind a computer that control all this stuff. It has to be programmed. Mm-hmm. And of course it is. So it's very scary, but yet again, it hasn't happened yet, but the direction's clear. And this is like, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz has said, you know, it's my words, not hers. It's now or never. I mean, you've only got maybe, I think her words were 1.5 years or something. And I'm in line with her. I don't think we have, time's running out. The hourglass, the sands are not many at the top. Most are at the bottom, and you've got to, you know, do what you can. And the best thing you can do is say no. And that's hard to do, especially if you're in a food crunch or a money crunch. You know, you lost your job and your savings is gone and you still got to pay rent. I mean, I get it. And this is, you know, this is under the main agenda to put the hurt on the people of the planet. I mean, if there's any war against humanity, it's what the elites are doing toward humanity, at least in the aggregate. Are there some elites that are good people? I'd like to believe so. But I've not been convinced yet. Mm-hmm.
As you're talking about the digital realm of everything, David, here, do you think that the role of cyber attacks will, you know, have a major part to play in this conflict?
Absolutely. It's going to be just like what we saw with Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and what happened in the banking crisis of 2008. The elite will pick their favorites. They'll do away with the ones they don't want, and they'll keep the ones they do. And it's that simple.
And, you know, as you were talking about, you know, the things that are hurting the general population here, do you think the sanctions that the U.S. and the rest of the world has been imposing on Russia are going to be effective or just end up, you know, hurting basically everybody else through inflationary pressures caused by lack of raw materials that Russia is exporting?
That's a tough one, very complex and unfolding as we speak. First of all, your last sentence is correct. It hurts everyone. So there's a boomerang effect, if you will. You know, what you throw out comes back to you. How much does it hurt Russia? Well, obviously it's hurt their currency, and that's, you know, hurts the people. And all these bankers' wars, you know, it's governments versus governments, it's ideologies, it's never the people. I mean, you know, at least not in this day and age. But I do think it does definitely impact the Russian people, and it affects everyone else. And again, there's nothing about war that, you know, really redeeming. And yet, you know, to be an advocate of principle, there are things that you need to stand up for. And sometimes they go to an extreme, and that's been played out through history. And I'll just leave it at that and leave it to the viewer's imagination to what I just said. Mm-hmm.
So if we think about the ramifications of Russia demanding payments for their energy exports in gold, how likely do you think that scenario is, and what considerations do we have to think about around that?
I think it's highly unlikely at this time. I think it would be kind of a last resort by Russia to do it. But I think it's a very good poker chip to put out on the table and scare people and get, you know, the gold market people and gold in general better recognized. I have, you know, some doubt as far as, you know, how this unfolds all the way. I don't think anyone knows. I think even the bankers think they know. It's not a sure thing. But it's highly likely, Tom, that we will see gold come back into the monetary system in some way, shape, or form, either officially or unofficially. I did an interview recently. I said, I think the major trend that a lot of crypto people aren't seeing, and this doesn't mean I'm right, but I've been a bit of a visionary on a few things, the cell phone industry being one of them. But regardless, I think you're going to see a lot more of the crypto space that goes to tangible assets, you know, cobalt, gold, silver, wheat, that kind of thing. So that coin, that token represents something in the physical realm. And, you know, the commodity space is wide open to that. So I think there's going to be a demand side on metal that doesn't exist or barely exists now, where a lot of the miners that have to go through the smelter and take whatever is basically being bid on them can make a deal with, let's say, someone that produces a gold-backed token, as an example, and go direct to them and use an offtake agreement or a streaming agreement of some type. So there'll be a whole new amount of buyers for precious metals, and that will put precious metals into this electronic platform, and it'll be a lot more easy to use. The one drawback that I know of is the weight and the value. I mean, it's tough to, you know, take your, I don't know, take 4 ounces of gold, you're looking at about $8,000. And then, you know, what if you got robbed and all that? And then don't worry too much about it. But the idea is if it's on your phone or on a platform, you can transfer that through the depository, and then the receiver can take it out in physical form or not if they choose to. So that's a big advantage. That's going back to the paper certificates of the goldsmiths. But let's add one more thing. The beauty of the blockchain is the ledger is immutable. You've got a really strong ledger that the bankers can't fool with. At least that's what's being told to us. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that, you know, whether unofficially or officially, they could back their currency with physical gold. Is there any advantage of, let's say, Russia moving first to be the first one, the first central bank to adopt that to maybe stabilize their currency? Or what do you think the, let's say, advantages, disadvantages are to, you know, China doing it first?
Yeah, well, again, this is opinion. I've thought about it a great deal, but I haven't thought through where I'm real sure. Mm-hmm. Whoever does it first does have an advantage, but it's got to be a major. I mean, if Peru did it, it wouldn't have any impact. But if China did it, Russia did it, the European Union did it, which is very unlikely. But if Russia or China did it, they would have a distinct advantage. And this would be further breakaway, especially if they did it without the current banking elite involved. In other words, if, you know, let's say Russia and China combine, they have a new currency that's gold-backed. It could be one or the other, you know, but this would have a huge impact, I think, against the current system, because the current system is pure fiat, as you know, and it's running out of time. It destroys itself, and it's designed that way. If you've ever watched my lecture about compound interest, you understand that you can't compound interest indefinitely. If God gave Jesus one penny at birth and compounded it at 3%, the compound interest on that one penny at 3% would be about 5 or 6 planet Earths right now. So obviously you cannot compound for 2,000 years and come out with anything other than a hyperinflation. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we're talking about energy, in your report there, you've analyzed the top 6 Russian oil and gas producers. So how do you see the risk right now of these equities, and how would you go about buying them if that's what you wanted to do?
Yeah, very high risk, but very high reward. And, you know, it's a bargain basement. It's just, you know, that crystal ball is pretty cloudy. You know, are you going to be able to get a two-way market? What I told my readers is, before you make a purchase, and here's the top 6, call your broker. And if you're on an electronic platform, there's always a customer service number, and make sure that there's a two-way market. In other words, I want to buy Luke Oil. If I want to buy it, can I sell it? And the answer is yes. And how long, you know, can I sell it? So as long as there's a market, I'd say it's worth some risk. Certainly, it would be a speculative situation. But, I mean, they're giving these things away as far as, you know, I mean, you talk about a value investor. Wow. And, but high risk. So that's what I said. Caution, caution, caution. Tread lightly. Make sure before you purchase, you can sell. It's easy, probably easy to buy, but it may not be. I mean, it just depends on the broker, how connected they are with that exchange. A lot of these things were on the ADR, American Depository Receipts. I think I know there's still a market, but you know, if things get more and more tense, what if, you know, that market goes away? So it's a tough one, but I like the values. And I think, again, if you do it correctly, you can bet a little to win a lot. I wouldn't go overboard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. I was looking at a couple of them last week, and you know, most of them are down something like 80%+. Those assets and those wells aren't going anywhere. That energy is going to be needed, but you know, the risk of anything happening to that that market is high, as you say. I know. I was looking at a couple of the pink sheet listings on some of them, and they've been frozen since March 3rd. So yeah. no real reporting on what the price has been since then. And, you know, as kind of in line with that, David, last week, of course, we saw that nickel trading was halted by the LME. So there's lots to talk about how that same situation could happen in the silver market, as it has the highest concentrated short position of any commodity. So what do you think has to happen for that to occur?
Ooh, yeah. I mean, I'm a broken record. First of all, I really don't know. But the most likely is it'd be a default of some type or something similar to the nickel. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's a demand for physical that cannot be met. Now, the exchange can never fail because in their contract, they could settle in cash. The cash settlement doesn't do anything. If you're making an iPhone, you need the silver. Mm-hmm. So once there is a default at that level or near that level, I think that's what it will take. The other thing is what's going on behind the scenes. And I've been talking about this on and off more this year than any other time. I used to do it in the very beginning when I, you know, was asked for interviews on the internet, but there's a lot of paper silver out there, and there's a lot of paper silver out there by well-known entities. For example, a lot of my friends in Canada have got these receipts from major banks in Canada, you know, BMO, TD, you know, there's many others. And the certificate says that they've got so many ounces of silver. And when they go in with this receipt to get their silver, the bank gives them cash. And so my point is that there's probably been a lot more silver purchases than we realize. And that maybe the entire silver market is already owned by somebody on paper, but there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between the amount of silver that people think they own and the reality of it. So if that were to come out in a big way, and it's already come out in small ways. I mean, Morgan Stanley was guilty of charging for silver and storing silver. They didn't have a vault. They didn't buy any silver. Mm-hmm. And instead of, you know, in my opinion, strongly, I think they should be banned from ever trading silver again forever. But no. They just got a little fine and they go on and do it again. Mm-hmm. And then you've got UBS did something similar. So some of these well-known banks and brokerages have done this. In fact, the Morgan Stanley case is just really fries me, Tom, because in their alleged retort to the court, it was standard practice in the industry to do that. In other words, it was standard practice to take people's money, pretend to buy silver, charge them for storage, and never have any on the books other than perhaps some derivative that would cover their base. So, you know, the lawyers go in to sue them and say, well, wait a minute. They're buying silver exposure. Read the contract these people signed. We never really told them they owned silver. They just were too stupid to read the contract, and they thought they were buying silver, and that statement said that, but the word silver doesn't equal the metal. So got to be careful. And it irks me because, you know, the problem with silver is you get too much for your money. I mean, Ted Butler made that statement years ago. And it's true. I mean, if you know, silver's too bulky. Well, do this thought experiment. Let's say that silver traded at the same price as palladium. Would it be too bulky then? No. No, the unit value would be above gold. Mm-hmm. So it's because silver has just been beat down by the derivatives markets for so long, and there's been enough physical to meet the demand so far. But let's, I want to go one step further, Tom. The demand, of course, is a tough one because the demand for silver right now is probably near an all-time high. And the demand for, let's say, silver eagles cannot be met. So if there were enough, you know, silver eagles in production where everybody that wanted to buy them at a reasonable premium, like, you know, $3 or something, was available, we don't know where the market would go. But there's, you know, that clog up in the market. Yes, it's a production problem, and yes, it's a retail product and all that stuff. I know that as well as anyone. But the point is that the demand exceeds the supply at that level. And so we really can't get a good idea. So we've got a lot of demand that's been met, and it's on paper. And then we have a lot of physical demand that can only be met by super high premiums. So there's a lot there that moves me toward thinking that this analogy to the nickel market is a possibility, definitely.
Yeah, it really points towards that disconnect between the paper price and the actual physical price that you can get a silver eagle for, or any ounce of silver for that matter, right?
Right. I mean, you know, I'm not in this camp exactly, but, you know, one of my friends says, you know, don't pay any attention to the paper price. You know, just go to your coin dealer and ask him how much it costs to buy some silver. Mm-hmm. And that's true on the retail side. But as I said, there's been enough silver that's been coming off the exchange that nothing's really blowing up yet. So if you're an entity, problem is most of the deliveries and, you know, offtakes off of silver, not that some doesn't move in industrial applications and that, of course it does. But a lot of it's just really bank to bank. I mean, this pile with JP Morgan's name on it goes over and has, you know, HSBC put on it. And HSBC goes over and has, you know, some other entity put on it. So it's a pee under the shell game for a lot of it, not all of it, but it is the largest short, as you said, and that's added risk. And I think these banks would like to mitigate that problem, but I don't think they can. I think they're pretty well trapped, but it's been that way for years. So just because they have oversold the market and can't get out unless they get much higher prices, and they are forced to cover their shorts at a high price and take a loss. Until we see that take place, we just have to wait. And people are tired of waiting. Tired of waiting.
Yeah, to your point there about the, you know, the local coin shops. I had a friend and a listener tell me last week that he had talked to his local coin shop, tried to buy some silver, and he said that most customers are only allowed to buy 25 ounces at a time. And in Alberta here, it's something like $6 above spot. It's just absolutely crazy.
And that goes back to demand. Let me do one more thing. I've thought about this. I don't think I've written about it, not that it matters, but let's say that the standard industry for the silver market was kilo bars. So instead of 1,000-ounce bars, they were kilo bars. Think about that. If that were true, then there'd be a lot of direct sales off of the COMEX, because a kilo isn't that much. There might be a limit. You might have to buy, I don't know, 30 kilos or something as a minimum contract. But nonetheless, that's a ready form for the investment side. And that would have a big impact on the the demand side, where you could deliver into the retail market. Obviously, that's not true. And the industry's been 1,000-ounce bars for years, and I'm sure it will remain that way. Mm-hmm. But there's an arbitrage there that some manufacturer could take those 1,000-ounce bars and pour them or extrude them and make kilo bars. And it's costly, it's time consuming. And of course, there'll be a premium. Mm-hmm. But I think that's something. And again, going back to what we talked about earlier, when the demand comes from people that want to use it as money, or let's say backing a cryptocurrency, which is more and more all the time, then you're going to see some competition for the metal itself. I mean, there could be a contract with, you know, an entity that wants to buy silver and pay, you know, 3% above spot every month or whatever. A lot of silver is sold at a discount because it's a byproduct metal. So if you're buying it from a smelting standpoint or whatever, you may be able to get it at a discount if you're a copper miner or whatever. A lot of the big copper, lead, zinc mines basically use silver off on an accounting basis and use it as an offset to their costs of their primary metal. So silver's got a lot going for it, but it has stuff that does that works against it as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and kind of to your earlier point too, if the deliverable form was kilo bars and they didn't have them, of course, they can just settle that in cash, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. No, you're right. And thanks for bringing that up. But I think it was kilo bars rather than, you know, seeing, I think you'd squeeze it a lot easier because there'd just be demand, demand, demand. And all of a sudden, you know, the internet would be flooded with people saying, hey, I wanted to get my contract and it settled in cash. And so that's all legal. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute, the demand was, you know, five times what they delivered last month. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. The market's broken. It's not working. But the COMEX was designed, like all the futures markets, to be a hedging facility and a derivative market. I mean, when you buy silver on exchange, you're not buying silver. Now, you may as well be buying wheat, because what you're buying is a derivative of the overlying commodity. And in rare cases, like 1% of the time, you actually take delivery of the commodity. The rest of the time, you're playing these games. And so you think about a trading desk that can move silver, let's say, 50 cents in a week, mm-hmm. and they're on the right side of the trade every day. So if you go, you know, up and down 10 cents 20 times in a day and make that trade over and over, I mean, you could come out with a $20 bill on every ounce of silver that's on your derivative book again and again and again. So they don't care what the ultimate price is because they're making so much paper off of this game that they want to keep it. They want to continue it. The only way to keep a lid on it is, as we talked about again, third time, is you got to sell a lot on paper, mm-hmm. keep that price where it's at. And it could blow up. Will it blow up? Looking for it for a long time.
Absolutely. You know, and I wanted to kind of go back to one of the other points that you had mentioned there, the piece that you said about standard industry practice for selling silver, let's say that's not there. That's, you know, of course, basically committing fraud. So, you know, you and I have spoken before with John Adams about these types of storage programs, you know, paper, quote unquote, paper silver storage programs. How big of a problem do you see that being in this industry in, you know, in today's day and age?
Well, this is an educated guess. So it's only a guess mm-hmm. because there's no way to know. But I think it's 300%. I think that for every person or entity or pension fund or whatever that's getting a piece of paper saying they own silver, either owns part of it or a derivative of it. And if you took, so let me say it in plain English. If you took all the paper silver and you put it in one pile, and you put all the physical silver and you put it in another pile, there'd be a 3-to-1 cover ratio, meaning there'd be three times as much silver that people think they own, and 1/3 of that that's actually there. Mm-hmm. So I think, and that's, I think, conservative. So it's that bad. That's huge. I mean, you know, if you go into a store and you buy, you know, three steaks and you only get one and the other two are on a piece of paper saying this is a steak derivative, you know, if we ever catch up, you can come in and collect your other two steaks. Mm-hmm. You know, what good would that be?
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy to think about, and it just makes one think about what the circumstances would be to have some type of discovery like that get triggered, right?
Right. And it's almost impossible the way it's mm-hmm. set up, because you can mm-hmm. settle in cash and there's swaps between dealers, and the bullion banks hold the majority of the physical and they all know each other and they play their games. And then you get in a situation like palladium or nickel. I mean, exchange still has control because it's in their warehouse and they actually dictate who could get it out and on what terms. So, you know, main thing is the banks. And, you know, my view on banks is, you know, as we talked about, I'm going to digress, Tom, but mm-hmm. we talked about it a while back after the Silver Symposium. What's your main difference between you and Jeff Christian? I said, on silver, as far as the fundamental stuff go, not much. But we definitely have a different view on the banking system. Mm-hmm.
So how important do you see silver being relative to oil, David?
They're very highly correlated. And I think oil is without a doubt the most important commodity on the planet, bar none, probably three to ten times more important than silver. I don't know, but silver is the second most important. And because of that fact, a lot of people you could store silver. And you can store oil, but not very well. So in other words, the average investor can take a position in silver in many different ways, mm-hmm. but taking a position in oil has to almost be a derivative for the average investor, either an oil company or an oil futures or ETF or something along those lines, where silver is the one that you can take possession of. And the problem is, you know, we keep talking about is that you can believe you own it. And in actuality, if you read the contract, you actually have a derivative, even though you may be, in some cases, paying a storage fee, for example. Mm-hmm.
So, David, you know, looking forward here, what do you think we could see for the gold to silver ratio? Where could that get to?
Well, you know, I'm very bullish on silver. And I think the ratio, you know, I wrote about this years ago. There's a document out there somewhere. I think it's probably still on my website, called Engineering the Price of Gold. And everybody wants to know what's the paper price of gold. That's a very easy thing to do. Just take the M1 money supply and divide by gold, and you've got dollars per gold. And right now, that's last time I did it, it was north of 15,000. And then you got to look at the gold silver ratio. Well, in monetary terms, the ratio is 15-1. So if you took 15 into 15,000, you get $1,000 silver. Now, I'm not saying you're going to get, I'm on record saying $100 silver. But in a breakdown scenario, especially when the monetary system is going to be reset, we just don't know when or exactly how, a lot of distortions will take place. And something like silver that's so imperative next to oil, maybe foods, I'd say food's more important than silver. So I'll retract my previous statement somewhat. But yeah, for a commodity, well, it's very, very important. So you could see a readjustment price vis-a-vis, you know, gold. In other words, so much silver buys an ounce of gold. And the one thing that's really held silver back is the fact that it's not treated as money. Mm-hmm. I did a whole lecture series. I think you interviewed me when I did that 3 or 4 times. What if silver were treated like gold? So if any investment bank, merchant bank, anything but a bullion bank, held silver as a monetary asset, you'd have the market on a lot different ratio than you have right now. In fact, I got to digress because this is a fun story, but I had a rather significant hedge fund manager from Asia call me, and he'd been through some of the old studies on silver, and he said, this is it. If we own the silver, it's like owning the oil market. And he wanted me to do a white paper, whatever. I want to go down the rabbit hole too far. The idea was, why aren't any of these entities? And I think it's a wink and a nod. I think, and I'm just thinking, I don't know. I don't want to sound like everything I see is a conspiracy. It's just that we did have the demonetization of silver in 1873 and officially in 1965 in the United States. China was the last to come off the silver standard, and they got screwed. And so there's been so much around the silver market that if you really look at it, it's almost an unbelievable story, especially if you even go to the Bill Still film, you know, Secrets of Oz, where he really breaks down that the Wizard of Oz is just a whole metaphor. You know, if we want to go back to Kansas, we click our silver slippers, because silver is what Frank Baum put in the book, not ruby. They put ruby in the movie just to distort it, because they don't want the people waking up to the fact that all we've got to do is put real money in the people's hands and we've got some control and we can go back to Kansas. So maybe we should end it there. I don't know.
Well, that's actually what I was going to say. That's an interesting place to kind of to kind of wrap up this interview today, David, is there anything else you'd like to add before we do?
Well, I'd like to thank you. I think you're one of the top interviewers. I'll say it publicly. You know, you really do your homework. And thanks for giving everyone a forum and asking for both sides and not really leaning one way or the other. It's hard to do because, you know, as in the human experience, we all get our worldview, and it does prevent us at times from being as objective as we think we are. But, you know, buy silver. The main problem, again, is it's been held down. And the other problem is people get enthused and maybe over-enthusiastic. I probably have bought, you know, allocation-wise, probably would have been better off not taking as much on the physical side as I have, but I'm not going to complain about that. I'm grateful I'm able to do it. But had I put more into the equity side or diversified a bit more than I have into other, let's say, stocks or whatever, probably have a better net worth on paper. But, you know, my mission statement is to teach and empower people to understand the benefits of an honest financial system, which is what benefits everyone. So If you want more information, go to themorganreport.com and get on our free newsletter.
Well, David, I appreciate those kind words. And, you know, it's, you know, as you're talking about, you would have been better off to maybe buy some more equities or what have you. It's kind of hard to be able to keep your finger on the pulse of everything, right? And I think that's something that a lot of, you know, everyday people need to hear, that it's you can't do everything, right?
That's right. You know, I mean, we get a day at a time. That's a good way to approach it. Sure, you got to look at the future and plan and all that, but no, you just got to. I think the main thing that's been missing, going back to the impetus of greed and jealousy, is to be balanced. You know, you don't want to be jealous of anyone, and you don't want to be greedy. When you have enough, you have enough. If you have more than enough, maybe you should think about sharing or how to mitigate it or what you can do with it. You know, there is a balance, and we in the West are very out of balance on so many issues. And nature has a way of bringing you back into balance, and that's what we're experiencing now. And it's going to be through the one thing that touches everybody, and that's the monetary sphere.
Excellent, David. Well, of course, you're also available on Twitter at SilverGuru22. And as you said, the MorganReport.com. Thanks so much for your time today, David.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.